Oh, there's the music, folks. Welcome to Wednesday, every second Wednesday.
Oh, good Kelly, to have you back, Chris.
Had to take a week away, but you know, other pressing priorities. Seeing that Kelly's in the chat already, ready to jam. Good to see it. Good to hear it. Hope everybody got their workout. Did you do stretches, Paul, before we started today?
I feel that I must have because I didn't pull anything this time.
There we go. Yeah, yeah. Too much shoulder shrugging and now I'm sore all day. Yeah, yeah. Hey, everybody, welcome to Instructional Designers in Offices Drinking Coffee, hashtag idiotic, sponsored by Domino One, the solution organizations rely on to create, manage, and deliver learning content efficiently at scale. Check us out at domino.com. That's domininknow.com. And hey, gang, today we have Connie Malamad with us. Connie, I think most folks have probably bumped into you somewhere, either in the blogosphere or at conferences, et cetera, but there may be some folks who haven't met you yet. So introduce yourself to our gang here today.
Yes, thanks. I'm always amazed at how many people I don't know. The field just keeps growing and growing. I've been in the field about 25 years. Can't leave. I just can't get out. Can't stop. I started writing the e-learning coach. I call it a blogazine. Feels more like a magazine to me. And you won't believe this, 2009. I've deleted all of those old articles. There's still 360 left. And I have a membership community called Mastering Instructional Design where we have events and I have a lot of courses. I've just been doing what everyone's been doing, creating learning experiences, learning and changing as things move along. I had a focus on visual design because I used to be an art major and wrote a couple books about that, and that about sums it up.
Fabulous. Over the years, your site has been something that I've turned to a lot for resources when I want to think about or understand things, particularly around visual design, because I come at this world as a words guy, a degree in literature and a career prior to this, or time prior to this in writing, et cetera. So for me, that was always a gap. You want words typed out. That's great. You want things that look nice. I gotta get some help. I gotta learn more about that. And that's actually been part of my funnest part of my journey in this space really is getting better at visual design over time. And your site's been tremendously helpful in all of that for me over the time. So we're talking today, of course, about visual design, but making sure that we're going to focus on how it's effective for learning experiences, but also with the aspect of accessibility to be considered as well, because things can look really great, but they don't necessarily work for everybody in different contexts, et cetera. When did accessibility, you know, hit your radar as something that beyond great looking designs, when did it become a thing of importance for you?
Well, you know, it's so strange. It was actually when I was a kid, because I grew up with a brother who had learning disabilities, but he was also a musical savant. So my mother was teaching him multiplication tables by singing. She was just doing a lot of music to get him learning how to read and how to do math. Because of that, I've always been kind of interested in it. And when I went to graduate school, I thought I would major in something that had to do with special ed, but then it all turned into instructional design. So I'm kind of keyed into it as soon as it started happening. You know, I understand about how important it is to be inclusive.
Right on. You had the blessing of that experience.
Yes.
From early on, as opposed to so many folks who don't have, you know, that kind of an experience and have to bump into it later on. So lots of hellos in the chat, by the way. It's awesome to see. Loving it. Anyway, sorry, just caught my eye. Can't resist saying hello, giving the shout out. So let's talk about some of the basics. How does visual design help with just learning in general? Before we get into making it then better for everybody?
There's a lot of research that shows for people who are sighted that processing visuals takes up at least 50% of our cortex, the outer layer of the brain. So we're just, for sighted individuals, we're very, very visual oriented. It's the prominent sense. So therefore, when we leverage visuals to help people learn, we're just being totally aligned with how the brains of sighted individuals work. Visual design, most people are not taught about graphic design, visual design. I like to call it visual design because graphic design seems to be so geared towards marketing. And they can be a lot more clever than we can. We have to like be simplistic. We have to reduce the noise. We can't make cool posters where you have to like sit there and figure it out. You know, we need people to perceive and process visual information very quickly.
I was kind of wondering about that. And I think that's a good apt analogy is, you know, often when people are first getting in, they're like, oh, that's cool.
Right.
That's beautiful graphic. And there's no doubt it is beautiful, but how is it supporting the message that you're trying to convey and help the overall learning experience? And I'm thinking, of course, that's relevant to sighted individuals and everyone there, but I'm thinking of not just people that don't have sight, but also or limited sight or people that have learning disabilities, other types of things. And how does that kind of, other than maybe it's just more so in terms of importance, but what are some of the things that you think about when you're thinking about visual design for the various different types of disabilities and making sure it has a positive impact across the spectrum?
Right. Well, certainly for people who are using screen readers, there's a large body of knowledge about alt text and how to explain images and the different types of images and, you know, when giving an explanation is good, when it's too redundant and you need to use the null, you know, double quotes. Information graphics are not so great for screen readers. In fact, they're not good. And you should always have a secondary explanation if you're using information graphics. So a lot of people may leave information graphics out, actually, because of the problems of trying to take someone through that through audio. But what was the question?
What are some of the differences or things that maybe you need to pay attention to even more in your design when you're thinking about, hopefully that design actually supports every learner, but or the learners that we think of typically, when we're not thinking of anybody with learning disabilities or whatnot, but what are some other aspects either they need to pay attention to more or add into their design choices?
Well, another thing is that's even more reason that our design should not be confusing. Think about neurodivergent learners. If you have to process not only, you know, new information, you're building a skill, you're building knowledge, and you have to process a very complex visual, that's just going to cause overwhelm. So I always say and think, it's like a little depressing for me, but you can't be too clever, you know? You just can't be cool and clever, and you just have to, like, make things as simple and clean as possible. And seeing Kevin here reminded me that he made the illustrations in one of my books for a whole topic about reducing realism, that illustrations, and he drew the comics for it. The illustrations are actually often easier to process. The fewer marks on the page, the fewer visual cues, are often easier to process than something complex. So let's say you were first learning car repair. It's a good analogy. When you open up the hood of a car and you don't know anything and you look at that, it just looks like a mess. Like, what is this? You see all these different components. A photograph for a newbie would actually be worse than a simple illustration. Just the outline of the parts that were labeled. That's the example of reducing realism. That's actually easier for people who are new at a topic to learn than complex photographs. I feel like that's really not intuitive. I would have thought, oh, give everyone a great photograph, you know?
Yeah, no, it reminds me a lot. We had a guest on earlier this year talking about accessibility, written word too, of, again, the simplification of it, again, not being too clever on there, which sometimes I think those of us who have advanced degrees tend to want to use it because we enjoy that aspect of it there, whether it's visual or not. But I'm thinking back to some car explanations and diagrams showed, and it was a drawn illustration of that. And then it had just the main overviews and then the big visual of this is the part we're focusing on. So,
oh, I love those magnification drawings where you take a one little part and then you stretch it out and you have a circle and it's magnified. Those are the best.
Mm-hmm.
I get excited about them.
Even the idea, we could even take it a step back because it has parallels too with the way that subject matter experts often, you know, provide us with information by giving us everything, you know, about a topic and everything that could possibly, our role is to focus it down to what's core, what's needed, and what's the best way to move things through.
Right.
And also what struck me too, was I went, oh, wait a minute. Is that why comic strips are so effective? Because they get the details out of the way and they get you straight to the zing. Yeah, interesting.
So I think they are. And the interesting thing is we're not just doing it for accessibility purposes, but then it's good for everyone. And that's what's just so amazing. And I think all the experts in accessibility, which I am not, will talk about how, you know, curb cuts are actually good for lots of different reasons. Somebody with a baby stroller, somebody with a bicycle. So it's the same thing for us. As we simplify, we help everyone understand. So win-win.
And that kind of thing, Tina had a good question, I think, in there that we should address there is, if you're using infographics, is it an accessible companion PDF an acceptable solution? And it makes me think of, again, some of those original articles there, but one of the things that people did at first, a lot of times with e-learning, is they had the Word version or PDF version, the text version of that. And of course, we've moved a lot away from that because you can make things accessible, but it's a great question because if you have a big infographic and it's actually a graphic, you could put in screen reader text in addition to alt text because alt text does have that limit of about 100 characters that you can count on. But what are your thoughts on that? Of what's a good way to handle that if you have a good infographic that visually does some good designs, but obviously is a gap for other folks?
I think it's probably better if somebody's doing something online, and I feel like I need to go double check with one of the experts, but I think it's probably better, Tina, to have it in a format where the screen, where they don't have to open up a new document. And I'm wondering if there could be a link to something, to the broad explanation, and maybe you could link to your PDF, but I don't think having a downloadable document, it's giving them quite the same experience. That's our goal, to give people the exact same experience or a similar type of experience. And maybe that's what you meant, a PDF that they could click onto. But I'm thinking that maybe a web page might be better. And I feel like I need to check with somebody to say for sure.
Yeah, I was thinking too about that. I mean, the Nationals, you got a great graphic there and describing it, but maybe it's better breaking that graphic up into pieces. And then you could have that description reading in that way.
That's true. That's another way to do it. Yeah. Paul's suggestion is good. Just something we just always have to try to keep in mind that we're giving someone a similar experience. So.
Yeah.
I feel like, Tina, why don't you email me and I'll ask one of, like, Sarah Mercier. She would know, like, 100% what's the best answer. And Susie Miller. There's a few experts who could tell you, yes, this is the best way. So if you email me, I can email them and find out for sure.
Excellent. One of the other great things I've seen in AI is they've started to create, and it's been for a while in some areas, create closed captionings automatically for different visuals. But then also what I've started to see is AI tools to help create alt text. I'm wondering if you've had any experience in that. We'll share a post, the link to one of our community articles that has a few links to some of the tools that were at least conditioned to hopefully create good alt text. But I was wondering if you've experienced any of that with your work with folks there and the ups and the downs that you've seen.
I read somewhere when I was learning and reading about accessibility and AI that you can't rely on those. Now, I'm not saying that you can't. But because I read that one time, I just never tried to use them. And maybe, you know, and things keep getting better and better. So I think if you use them, as always with AI, and I'm sure everyone who's here knows this, you always have to double check. I just got a newsletter, you know, Philippa Hardiman, who has an AI newsletter. And she said that the summaries aren't very good. And I've seen that. AI summaries, you have to check that. By the time you're done checking everything, it does save you some time, but it's not as much time as you would like. So if you are going to use that, I would double check.
Yeah, I've kind of seen some of the same in my own experience researching things and having things that are interesting conclusions that sound very convincing, but if you actually step back or you know it's not quite right there. And there's an interesting article about folks in radiology that were using AI and their ability to actually correctly identify things actually went down as they started to use AI, apparently because maybe they were relying on it. And of course, if it was wrong, they missed it sometimes.
Interesting. Okay. Well, it looks like Ilya has posted an article. So
yeah, there's that's a link. There's a few different AI generators there that were specifically for some of that type of stuff. I mean, this world doesn't stand still, just like anything else, instructional design and accessibility. I haven't researched too much, but I know, of course, in the WCAG, which are the standards folks go out for, there's a 3.0 that they've been working on, which is the successor to 2.2, I think, is the current one on there. One of the other things is some of the laws in Europe have started to kick in or either be reinforced or enhanced, I've noticed too, because there's a lot more folks paying attention. Do you have any insight into the newer standards or things in terms of how folks are starting to perk up and pay attention to accessibility and visual design with some of these laws basically encouraging folks that perhaps haven't had a personal experience? And I'm going to go ahead and say shout out to Galveston out there. They have a fantastic brain injury rehab facility there that I worked at. And that was one of my many introductions to some of these issues too.
Wow, that's amazing. It certainly does seem like it's become even a specialty within instructional design and very important on someone's resume that they do know that. So I think the importance of inclusive design, barring any political BS, has really increased and grown. I don't know about if all companies are getting on board, but it does seem like more and more people are. As far as 3.0, it's been interesting because there have been some issues around color contrast not really simulating the way we perceive contrast. So whenever I look it up again, it says 3.0 is a long way off. So what have you heard? Have you heard that it's happening?
I'm not. I just hear it kind of bubble up once in a while. But I also remember from when the 2.0, the 2.1 and 2, you know, they were talked about long before they actually became adopted, which on some level, I'm kind of happy about because if it's a standard people are adhering to, unlike a software release or a new policy change or something, they've actually really thought it through. So that's right. Always been good, at least in passing. I'm assuming that's probably the case here with the 3.0. So,
well, the one thing about contrast is if you use those contrast checkers, which I do try to use most of the time, you'll see some things that seem a little bit off. So you'll see it say that text on a particular background, it's low contrast, and text with another set of colors, it's high contrast, and yet you're perceiving it differently. Did that ever happen to you? Anybody out there, did that ever happen? It happens to me. And it turns out that all of our contrast tools are using an algorithm or a model that doesn't quite replicate human perception. And somebody has been working on that. I wish I could access the link right away. I have a link somewhere to one of the newer tools that's supposed to be better, and it does seem better.
So is that an issue that is for the contrast that everyone perceives, or is it certain people that have certain different red, blue, or whatever? There's multiple different disabilities there in terms of perceiving colors there that I know that comes into play, but yeah.
Well, okay. This doesn't have anything to do with color vision deficiency, just the way we humans perceive contrast.
Hmm.
The contrast checkers aren't always 100% right. And that happens. You'll see that. And if I see that, I'm really sensitive to contrast. If I see that, I'll, if they say this is good, but I don't think it's good, then I'll just make something even darker until I think it's good, you know. So I listen like 90% of the time. But let's see, does Kevin say anything? If it doesn't reduce, back on.
He's stuck on alt text. We've been there, guys.
Well, back in illustration.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, Kevin.
Oh, yes. Lines of illustration. I interpreted it as lines of text.
Yeah, but you know, that's great with the illustrations. And I think that brings it back full circle, if you will, there to that photographic image that has a lot. And it's, I think Kevin summarized as well, there's a lot of visual noise
right
in there. And so when you're having illustrations, and you can have all sorts of varieties of illustrations and what's illustrated there. Some of them have a lot of noise, and that's on purpose. That's part of the design, but it's not designed to instruct you on something like we're talking about here.
Yes. And some of the ways, some chapter somewhere I wrote, it's called Reduce Realism. And it's about noise can be shadows. It can be depth. It can be too many colors. It can be textures. There's so many things that you can kind of strip away, and our brains are amazing. Like, people can recognize what a silhouette is doing, you know, the action of a silhouette. It can recognize, when you think about it, it's amazing, the action of a line drawing. And there's nothing in the universe, in the physical universe, that looks like a line drawing, but yet we can recognize it. So our brains fill in so much of the missing information. It's just so fascinating. Sometimes, like, I can't find the right image. When I was a manager, like, somebody said, I can't find the right graphic. And I go, it's okay. Their minds will fill in the gaps. Just you know, go meet the deadline. I was counting on that.
And I'm curious, back to the visual design there, have there been certain cases where you said you looked at something and you were helping somebody with that, or you're designing yourself, and it's like, oh, this is good, but for this segment of the audience, this aspect of it, or these types of, do you see certain types of aspects that are used over and over again that probably shouldn't be because it's not good for neurodivergent or any other particular?
Well, I mean, if there's too much on the screen and not enough white space, which of course can be any color, it's just a space with nothing in it, that can be a problem. And it really is, like I was saying before, it just benefits everyone. But one of the big ones might be, people may not be aware that in a color vision deficiency or color blindness, that red and green are the top two color, let me get this right. It's the top color combination that people with color blindness cannot differentiate. So basically, you never want to use color alone as an indicator.
Yeah, and that is one of those WCAG rules. And if you do, it's basically does not meet. There's no exception for it.
That's right. And then the next one is blue and yellow, and that's much fewer people have that one. And almost no one is truly colorblind by red. It's a misnomer. So color vision deficiency is a mouthful, but it's more accurate.
And red and green in particular, of course, in our world are so often used as indicators, particularly with question responses, correct or incorrect.
Right.
That's our cultural default in a sense, at least for us, I would say, in the Western world.
You still use it. Just put a check mark and an X.
Yeah.
Just put a symbol.
Just like there's a reason in stoplights of the order. Because many people can't go ahead and distinguish that color, but they know that the top or the bottom is the go or the stop, which I'm not remembering at the top of my head right now because I'm not paying attention to that aspect of it there.
You know, that's kind of funny that we chose red and green to represent go and stop when that's the worst combo you could pick. What are we doing?
About us there, but Yeah, Dan had another good question. I'm curious too. And of course, when it comes to simplifying graphics, which is an important thing, what about the style thing? Is, you know, cartoon versus realism? I think there might be a case for realism used in there, but again, thinking it realism simplified, what's your thoughts right on that?
Well, you know, in terms of characters, I do believe that some of those transparent people in different poses, you know, they're fine. They seem to be fine. I don't think people have trouble processing them because we're so used to seeing people, you know, not anything mm-hmm. unusual, as opposed to the components of a car engine or something like that. But I do think that cartoon versus realism in terms of illustration depends on the context, the audience. I always think of if I were making training for baristas, which I've never done, but it seems like it would be really fun. I would do things one way. And if I were making graphics for bank executives, you know, it would look quite different. So context and audience and content might really affect that. If you're writing about a disease and how to care for someone who's very ill, that's going to have a totally different vibe than, you know, a sunglass company.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about, we have some good friends with Domino at Starbucks, and they have the barista training, and I've seen a few shots of some of that stuff, and it's naturally some realistic pieces on there, but they do use a lot of cases of, hey, here's the overview, but they always are zooming into pieces there, showing you how to use the equipment properly and what to go ahead and do with that. I wasn't thinking about the time, but they're applying some pretty good principles there.
That's great. And also, I think we have to know, you know, there's that expertise reversal effect. I've never really heard about that as it applies to graphics, that particular principle. And that is that principle is that if you give experts the same training as novices, there's just too much guidance. It like messes them up because experts have a way of doing something. And all that extra information is going to hinder their learning. But there's that same thing with, you know, an expert mechanic is probably going to need a pretty complex drawing, or even a photograph might be okay for the expert. One thing I always think of is just try it out. Like, should I give this expert a complex illustration or a photograph? Make a prototype, try it out with 3 to 5 experts, and, you know, you'll get your answer. Forget the research. You know?
That kind of sparks another question. In every training, hopefully, folks are using goes through quality assurance steps. You're making sure that it meets the audience's needs. You don't have any obvious it's broken links or things like that. But in terms of quality assurance for accessibility, and of course, we've talked about in the past how it's important not to add accessibility afterwards. It's not the frosting after the cake is done. You put it in the batter, so to speak.
Right.
The process from the beginning. But from a quality assurance standpoint, are there any tips or things that you see that people typically forget that they should go ahead and do? Or if they're trying to improve their overall process, again, I always said accessibility is a journey. You don't need to be perfect out of the box. If you made 10% improvement, that's a great improvement. Just keep doing that.
Well, you know, I'm sure, I know Hadiya Nuruddin has been doing a lot on quality assurance. I'm guessing she may have actually, Sarah in her new book. I'm wondering if they have checklists there for accessibility and the visuals. But I would just always really make sure that the contrast is correct, that you're not using color combinations, color alone to convey information, that you're using appropriate color combinations, and that your alt text is appropriate. Those are the 4 things I can think of off the top of my head in terms of visual design that I put on that checklist. But I'm sure there are checklists around. Does anybody know of one? I'm sure they have them. I mean, there are a few people who are really focused on accessibility full time.
We'll see if the chat bubbles up anything for us.
Crowdsourcing.
From the smart folks that have joined us. It's lovely when folks join us and they're actually smarter than us.
Well, it's a group mind.
For sure.
We can't focus on all of it. So I count on everybody else to help me here. I have Sarah's book somewhere too, but I can't remember if there's a Design for All Learners, it's called.
And I can't
the checklist in there. No.
Yeah, Sarah was with us for an episode in the spring. And I remember her holding the book up and then turning it sideways and how bloody thick that thing is. Like, that's, there's so much there. Holy cow. It's definitely, it's not a light skimming of the topic for sure, which is awesome because accessibility is something, like Paul said, it's a journey. There's just so much and you can't be perfect right away. You can only sort of take the steps that you can take. So,
well, yeah. Her book, good too. And it gave multiple different perspectives on the same problem, which I think back to your earlier statement, Connie, you grew up with your brother who had a disability there. And some of us have had those experiences, but when we haven't, it's really eye-opening when you can go ahead and do. And that's one of the things I really liked about the format of her book.
Me too. I love the stories were great. I mean, I haven't finished reading it, but the stories were great. You know what else is great? If you haven't done this yet, using a screen reader to see how complicated it is and to see how something that you wrote in your alt text that you thought was great is actually, you know, not that good. and all the odd phrases that it will read. And it just really helps you understand so much more. And it's easy. There are free screen readers you can just download and try it. That's very helpful.
Yeah. Dan has a question in the chat. A neat angle here. Scoping projects hasn't traditionally included accessibility. Can you discuss the time/money impact on designing for accessibility? I mean, do you have any thoughts then, Connie, on like, do you budget a certain proportion and say that this is, you know, accessibility, or how do things work for you?
I think that the thing that takes, well, first of all, as Paul said, it has to be done from the start. And that makes it take a lot less time. Nothing like having to rework something. Mm. And I think as teams get faster with it, it becomes almost habit. Like I'm using Storyline, I have to put in alt text. It becomes second nature to start thinking in terms of accessibility. I know it is for me. But see, here's a good one. Pack checker is helpful. Can you tell us what that does? Patricia, can you text include that? So I think it does take more time, but I don't have a number for that. But I think the time gets reduced as a team becomes more experienced. And in the end, it makes it better for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that's a big thing there too, is, and I echo what I've seen there too. If you have to do it after the fact, it's pretty significant. If you start doing it as part of the process, it's not nothing, but a lot less there. And you get two big impacts, I think, that affect that ROI or the cost that people are looking at. And one is it's making it better for everyone. Folks that don't have disabilities also appreciate the same aspects of that graphic design and other aspects of the training in terms of elements. And then also there is that audience out there that isn't getting the training or isn't able to understand that. And that's having a negative impact on them and the business. And if you are concerned about lawsuits and things like that too, that obviously is starting to happen more and you're preventing there, just like your classic compliance training. You don't go ahead and say, well, we shouldn't spend money on that. You're already doing it because you know it's not only the right thing to do, but there's a lot of consequences by not even having that training. So to me, you need to go ahead when people are questioning it, look at the whole spectrum and have them look at that. And then, like you said, if you're starting to put it in, and I've seen other teams with us, they start to put that into the templates, just like you create the templates and you're reusing elements. Perhaps if your tool allows you to do it, it already has that in part of the design. Or like in Domino, if you're putting in the description that fits a alt text automatically for an image, it's helping that authoring team find the image later because that's part of the search design there, and it automatically brings that into the training there. So I think you start to have these unexpected positive ripple effects.
And you know what? I thought of a new twist. Since AI saves us time during design and writing, thinking and adding whatever is needed for accessibility probably just balances it.
Well, that's a good point there too. And I think at all the other times, and I had a comment on a different case of you're saving this time. And isn't that save time better spent on not doing it the inefficient way and actually taking that to make the training better, maybe personalizing it for the expert and the intermediate folks. So they have slightly different versions in it, single sourcing design and things like that, or making sure everything is accessible and making your training a more powerful experience.
So Dan is saying that he still has to sell it. And a lot of times that is our job, to educate people and build a business case so that they will do something. And I think that by being able to prove that it'll make learning better for everyone is a good business case.
I was thinking too, to his comment on there, and you know, there, all of our different industries do things at different times. Sometimes I've seen the learning team is leading the charge in accessibility, but in other cases, software teams, people building software or tools that are designed to build websites, have been dealing with this for a long time. Not everyone, of course, but there might be, and I'm just postulating there, that there might be some actual insight that you can gain from those other industries in terms of, because they've built that into their workflow.
Yeah.
I'm sure Microsoft and some of the other big ones, they don't put any, just go, maybe we'll do it. They're probably building it into it. They might actually have some good insight there for Dan, just a guess.
You know, yeah. I mean, it almost seems like once it's built into your workflow, it's so different than trying to do it afterwards. It's just part of how you do things. It just doesn't even have to take that much time. It's almost like do it under the radar. They don't even have to know.
I was just going to say, if you feel you need to sell it, maybe just start doing it. Even starting small with some things like making sure there's alt text to begin with, for starters.
Won't have much cost in terms of the impact for that. You'll be doing that, and you can feed that back into your additional information. And Patricia mentioned AI, and I think Dan had also asked, can you ask about the accuracy of tools? One of the tools that I've used in the past is from the company Axe, or maybe that's the name of the tool, AXE. And they have some very creative tools that you can actually build into your coding when you're building software. And they've started to leverage AI there, again, to make it extremely efficient. In fact, Axe might be a very good resource, Dan, because I know they've done a lot of research, because of course they have to help justify someone buying their tools. I know they've looked into some of those efficiencies and cost on there. Pretty sure that a lot of that stuff extrapolates in terms of those efficiencies.
Patricia, it looks like she's had a bad experience with alt text AI. So there you go.
I've had great experiences in researching as well. Wow, you found that resource and it was very accurate. And then other ones where that citation doesn't even exist, or it exists, but the conclusion you made from it was very spurious, very wrong.
Absolutely. That's happened to me too. Completely made up citations. I go, can you check that again? Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. It seems to be claimed a lot out here, but I can't find any source for that claim. Yes, no, right. That's a part of the challenge there. And also, speaking to tools, have you found that, like color, you mentioned color contrast tools. I imagine, I don't know for sure, that a lot of those tools use the same algorithms. And as you said, right now, they're finding that algorithm is not correct. So there's probably not much difference in terms of accuracy between one tool or another. But have you found that our other tools are, error prone or things that you need to look at? I know that I've certainly found things that I'm like, well, yeah, that's a flag. And technically it's incorrect, but it's still a fine experience. Even using screen readers, you have very different experiences if you're using JAWS or NVDA, or you don't know how to use JAWS and it's just, you have the settings wrong.
Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to imply that the contrast checkers are way off, but there's a certain range that seems to be off. That's all. I would encourage people to use them for sure. But there's just this one little area, and neither of you have experienced that, which makes me think I'm a freak, because I look at it and I go, that can't be right. But it's only this one little area, it's like that much is good. So I've been using WebAIM, and I think Adobe has one. And I've been happy with them. They're easy to use. They're good. The only thing that might be tricky, and I have a presentation and I've included this, is a lot of people aren't used to the concept of hex code, that every caller has a hex code. I mean, you can find it in Storyline, and I think you can find it in PowerPoint. It's just the alphanumeric 6 digits code for every letter. I mean, for every color, sorry. And then you have to put those into the contrast checker. And that could maybe mess up someone who isn't aware of that every color has that.
Yeah, and a lot of tools like Domino, they reveal that too. For folks who don't know, there's color pickers out there. Some True. Are browser-based, some are desktop and crossover, but all those color pickers can get that hex code for you, which if you haven't experienced it, that's definitely something you want to grab. It's kind of like the great number to go ahead and look at. There's a few different variations, but that's probably the most common one.
Yeah, that's what I've seen. Domino has it too, so that's good to keep in mind. And it looks like Patricia has a link for us. So thank you, Patricia.
Yeah, for the PAC reference that she made earlier. That's awesome. Lots of good sharing in this chat today here.
Yeah.
Connie, I'm going to suggest, just sort of looping back a little bit in our conversation, that your experience with those contrast checkers is probably a reflection of the fact that in the visual design realm, you are far more expert than Paul and I are. And your experience, et cetera, kind of fine tunes you, you know, for that kind of a process far more than it would for us, for sure. Connie, it's been an absolute joy having you with us here today. Such a great conversation. Thanks for joining us. Are you at any conferences or anything where folks can catch up with you?
No, I'm doing a lot of online things, but I keep missing conferences. I won't be.
They're planning it a year in advance and even further of if you're going to speak. And I know for you, usually you want to go ahead and speak there. That cover some costs there and another good reason to connect. So, yeah it's tough.
Where will Domino be? Which conferences?
We'll be at DevLearn. I personally will be there. And that's in mid-November this year. So they moved it back even four. They've been up in middle of October all the way to, I think this is the latest that they've been in a long time. So we look forward to folks that will be there. I think as usual, I think that's been a very refreshing thing is that at conferences over that, say the last 5 years, at least they continue to have more and more accessibility sessions continue to be covered there and kind of comes and goes a little bit on there, but it seems to not have faded away. It's continuing to gain, as we said, you know, part of the natural process and, a lot less of having to justify, as unfortunately Dan is having to do there. So,
back in my earliest time in this space, it was something that you'd only encounter if it was a government-related organization.
Yeah, and federal government at that too,
impacted by very specific legislation. And now it's very common across any kind of an organization for accessibility, you know, concerns to come up and have questions and that kind of a thing. So, hey gang, let's get ourselves wrapped up here. This conversation here today, as every week. Or every time we do that, idiotic instructional designers in offices drinking coffee is brought to you by Domino One, the tool that organizations use to effectively create, manage, and deliver their learning content across their organization. Check us out, DominKnow.com. Hey, folks, thanks for joining us. Great conversations and helpful tips in the chat, too. We really love that, guys. Thanks so much, gang. Catch you next time.